Hello, and welcome back to Linkery. Linkery is the show that asks and attempts to answer questions related to language and communication sciences. Every episode, you're joined by me, Aiden, an undergraduate student in speech-language hearing sciences, and my partner in crime here,
Emily. I'm also a graduate student in speech-language and hearing sciences.
So today, as we do in every episode, we're going to hear a question about language and communication, and we have an amazing guest speaker today to walk us through all of the nuances and all of the awesomeness that we'll uncover from this question. But first off, before we get to our linkery of the day, Emily, I was just wondering, based on what our listener has asked us today, are you good at imitating accents?
Not entirely. I can do a British accent fairly okay. Other than that, absolutely not. Nothing else. What about you?
I don't know. I'm okay. I do some acting, and so I'll try to like imitate accents. I'm sure it sounds better. I'm sure it sounds way worse than it seems to me when I'm doing it. But it's just interesting because I feel like in my family, even I'm decent at it. My dad is decent at it, but like, I'm trying to think like my brother, I remember like him asking me some questions about Spanish one time and him like doing the pronunciations, and it was, I mean, love him to death, but it was awful. And so I'm like, it's so interesting that some people are just so good at it and others aren't. And I wonder if that has to do with some of our topic today. I'm sure we'll be discussing it.
Well, even with me and you talking about this in the past, with you speaking Spanish as a second language, I was saying I have no idea how to do a Spanish accent. And that's what deters me from trying to learn the language. And you were like, oh, well, you just, you know, put your mouth in this position and use your tongue in this position. And that's how it, and I was like, wow, that was a very language-based answer.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's like all of the parts fit together somehow. And some people see the bigger picture easier, I guess. But okay. So without further ado, we are going to take a listen to our linkery of the day from one of our listeners here. We'll let her introduce herself, and then we'll bring on our guest speaker and get going. So here is today's linkery.
Hi, my name is Austin and I'm from Rhode Island. I have a question that's been on my mind since I discovered the show. So how does my brain understand the speech when I'm in a noisy place like a train station or a crowded line at a movie theater? I also feel like some people are really good at imitating speech sounds and, you know, like dialects and accents, and yet I'm terrible at it. Is there anything that explains this? Thanks, guys.
All right. Thank you to our listener for today's linkery. So you guessed it. Today, we're talking all about speech perception. You know, speech is this amazing ability that we have as humans to communicate verbally our thoughts and ideas. Speech is distinct from language. We talked a little bit about this in our other episode. But today we're going to specifically talk about all of the crazy mechanisms and processes that go on when the audio signal reaches our ears and goes to our brain. So today we have an amazing guest with us today. Emily, would you like to introduce our guest?
We have another Emily with us today, Dr. Emily Myers, cognitive scientist and professor of psychological sciences and speech, language, and hearing sciences at UConn, principal investigator at the UConn Language and Brain Lab.
Hey guys, nice to be here.
Hi, Dr. Myers. Thank you for joining us. You are the perfect person to kind of unpack today's central question, which is all about speech perception and the ways that our brain interpret the audio signal, and also why some people might be better at understanding all the nuances of speech and all the information that we get from the speech signal, while others aren't as either conscious of it or just aren't as good at manipulating it or being aware of it. So I guess our first question is like, are you good at imitating accents?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I'm kind of middle of the pack. Like, I'm not the worst, but I'm not going to win any Academy Awards. I'm not a Meryl Streep, you know? But I have to say, I've always been really fascinated by accents. It's one of those things where, you know, when you find your way into your career, you kind of realize there were hints of your origin story all along. Yeah. But like when I think the first time I really sort of started to understand how different accents and dialects could be, was when I moved from the Midwest to the East Coast. And I grew up in Iowa, and like the English that's spoken there, you know, has this kind of flat quality to it, and the vowels are pretty simple. And I moved to Rhode Island and I encountered the Rhode Island accent for the first time. And I mean, it was in a Dunkin' Donuts and the women were speaking with what I now know to be like a pretty normal Rhode Island accent. And I thought they were playing a practical joke on me. They had like seen my license plate and were like, we're going to mess with this lady. So that's, you know, how different accents can be and what's going on when you have that accent. Are all these changes in vowels, all these changes in the consonants, changes in the prosody or the rhythm of speech? And once you get used to it, we get pretty good at understanding those accents. And in fact, most people, you know, have no problem in listening to a Rhode Island accent versus an Iowa accent. But that issue of reproducing them, man, that seems harder, doesn't it? Some people just seem to really nail it and other people just, no matter how they try, really can't do that kind of mimicry.
Yeah. And I think that's going to be a big part of our discussion coming up. I think we would love to unpack that more. But before we kind of get into the specifics about, you know, cognitive science and speech perception, how did you find your way, you know, speaking of origin stories, how did you find your way to the field of cognitive science? And specifically, why do you look at language as a research area?
Such a good question. Yeah. You know, I like to tell this story just because I think there's sometimes an impression that, you know, professors have been sort of wearing those little leather elbow patches from infancy. You know, I grew up interested in language. I liked learning foreign languages. I was kind of interested in learning Spanish. Got to college. I really had no idea what I wanted to pursue. And like many people, picked from the list of kind of default professions that we have when we're little. And I was like, maybe I'll be perhaps a doctor. and I love science. So I took a lot of science courses. And along the way, I had a Spanish major. And so my view of myself was maybe I would be a Spanish speaking doctor and help the community. And I think that would have been great if it worked out. But I really realized along the way that I was not cut out to be an MD. I think I was watching a lot of ER. I don't know if you guys remember ER, probably
oh,
not.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was like, this seems scary. I don't want to do this. but really, you know, kind of discovered that some of the key questions that I was really the most interested in really had to do with how language is represented in the brain, how we manage to take this acoustic signal into our ears. It feels just totally effortless. You know, you hear something and you instantly understand it, but there's all of these processes that go along between the ear and understanding. And once you sort of start to kind of open that box, you realize how many cool questions there are to answer that we still don't fully know the answers to. I got admitted to grad school at Brown in their PhD program in cognitive science. And so kind of landed myself there really knowing very little about psychology, really knowing very little about neuroscience. But that's where my education started. And I think studying language is always endlessly fascinating, partly because we're doing it all the time. Right. If you're a human in this world, you are probably using spoken or signed or other kinds of communicative, you know, modalities that are all language. And, you know, it's how we relate to people. It's how we express big ideas. And so when it goes wrong, when you have a situation where you're not hearing well or you're not understanding well, it really impacts the way that, you know, you relate to people and you relate to ideas. So it's exciting to work on that topic just because it impacts so many aspects of who we are as human beings.
I think that's such an interesting answer. And I always find it's whenever we talk to any of professionals in speech and hearing sciences, it's so funny that usually people start out in something related, but not totally in the where they ended up. I just love to hear like all the different paths that people take to get to this specific niche that we're in.
Totally. Yeah. And the other thing I would add to that is that studying languages really needs people from different areas. Like you need people who are kind of nerding out on the structure of language, that are into sort of maybe a more linguistics approach. You need people who are more from a psychology background, who understand things like how memory works, and you need neuroscientists, right? And so That's kind of what cognoscience is it brings together all those perspectives. So it's especially fun to be able to draw from expertise from all those areas in my own work.
I know you've written about speech and the process of speech production a lot as a kind of invisible ballet. Could you give us a high level summary of what you mean by that term?
Yeah. So let's just maybe draw a line between speech perception and speech production. So you said it already, Emily, but people don't always think in these terms. When we're talking about speech perception, we're talking about what goes on from when you hear a spoken signal, it lands on your cochlea, and getting it into meaning. So processing those sounds, figuring out, you know, am I hearing a b or a p, an e or an ooh, all of those different kinds of what we call in my field phonemes, but you are thinking of probably as letters, and to map them onto meaning. So that process, you know, like I was alluding to before, feels really effortless, but there's a lot of kind of component things that have to go on. So as an example, when I say the word river, it's going to sound completely different from when Aiden, you, or you, Emily, say that word. It's going to sound different because of the pitch of your voice, which is determined by a lot of things, but one of them is whether you've gone through male puberty. It's going to be determined by the shape of your head, right? So it gets passed through your head, and those things sort of shape the sounds that come out. It's also going to be different depending on your dialect, right? And so we talked a little bit about my Midwestern dialect versus more East Coast dialect. And yet most of the time we like aren't even aware that there's any kind of adjustment that we need to make for all of those acoustics. So that process that we go through of hearing that input, which can be really, really different, and yet somehow getting to the same meaning, is kind of like an invisible ballet. Mm. On the speech production side, right, that's what we do to move our articulators to speak. And so in that situation, we kind of are reversing the process. We're going from a message that we want to convey to programming what our mouth is going to do to getting it out. And there too, you know, there's a lot of things that are going on that unless it goes wrong, right, unless we're having a slip of the tongue or, you know, a speech block of some sort, we're really unaware that there's much going on at all.
Wow. That's true. Yeah, that's a good point. I feel like, you know, even us that study speech and, you know, speech pathology and everything, it's so easy to forget that like speech is really just truly the biggest umbrella term, because there's all of these other, you know, speech production, speech perception, all of these things that kind of work together. But I love the thought of the invisible ballet. I think that's a really good way of putting it. Because like all the steps have to be very precise and perfect, but it's also when you take a step back and zoom out, it's this just seem effortless looking dance. So yeah, I love that.
Yeah. And I think not to get too woo-woo about it, but I think there's a lot of beauty in that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we have all of these interacting processes and they're helping each other out. We're feeding information from what we're hearing, but we're also combining it with what we know about the world and what we know about what people are likely to say. So, you know, if I'm talking along and I say, you know, sorry, you know, you're hearing my dog barking in the background, and I say something between barking and parking, you're instantly going to correct that. She meant barking, right? You're using context to fill in those gaps. Or if you're listening in a noisy environment and you can sort of hear every other word, you know, now that we're back in spending time in crowded bars, some of us are like realizing, oh my goodness, it's actually much harder to listen to speech and noise. But what we're doing is we're really kind of seamlessly integrating what we're hearing from what we expect and putting those two signals together. And that kind of integration of the signals really is kind of magical.
Yeah, that makes me think of something that we had discussed in a psycholinguistics class of mine, this whole idea of context effects. And I could be wrong, but it seems like that's a whole subcategory in itself on this topic of speech perception, like you were saying, because what we know about the world and what we, it's interesting. It's almost like there's a really quick, but also very fine grain and detailed statistical evaluation that our brains are making. Would you say that that's a fair assessment, or is that an oversimplification even in itself?
I think you kind of nailed it. I mean, I think there's lots of kind of technical debates about exactly how that process occurs and how quickly it happens, for instance. But one cool thing that we're working on in my lab, and this is led by my student Anne-Marie Crinian, is, you know, we think about that example I just gave you about the dog parking or barking. Mm-hmm. And we look across individuals, we all are able to use all sorts of information to try to figure out what that ambiguity is. Mm. But some people seem to really prefer to use that context. That is, if I said, you're hearing my dog parking, and I say a pretty good pee, they may report still that that word was really barking, right? They're really like using that context really, really strongly. Mm. And other people seem to prefer the acoustics of the input. They're like, kind of like, I'm not fooled. That was parking. It's not making any sense to me, but I'm going to rely on what my ears told me, not what my expectations are. So one question we truly don't have the answer to is, you know, are these kinds of preferences for which kinds of information you really trust more? Are you trusting what you're hearing? Or are you trusting what you're expecting you're hearing? Are those things that are kind of like a trait of people? And can we explore more what it means to be somebody who is a context user, who really loves to go with the expectation versus kind of an ear truster, someone who really goes with what they're hearing? One way that this could play out is that we know that when hearing starts to decline, and as we age, unfortunately, all of our hearing will probably take a turn for the worse. Yeah. I'm feeling it already, actually. In that process, it seems that we tend to rely more on context the worse our hearing is. That makes a lot of sense, right? If you're not hearing that well, you might rely more on context. But these individual differences, like are you a context user, are you an ear truster, might really play out in interesting ways in an aging population where all of a sudden that early signal is kind of degraded. We honestly don't know how it's going to work out. That's what Anne-Marie's working on.
I know we've touched on a lot of different topics within this question, but I kind of wanted to go more into depth with what exactly we mean when we say speech perception. I know we kind of touched on it already, but just to break it down to answer this question.
Yeah, exactly. So speech perception can be a little hard to define because, you know, it's not hearing, right? Hearing is something else, and it's not assembling meaning or understanding, right? It's kind of the step in between. Mm. So when we think about, you know, what sort of belongs to the field of speech perception, we think about, okay, the ear has received a signal, you know, we've got our ear working well, it's transmitting that to the brain. But almost right away, there start to be transformations on that signal. And so for instance, I'll give you an example. So we have vowels in English, like the vowel in bit, like I bit the Oreo, and the vowel in bet, like I bet you can't eat all those Oreos, right? So that distinction is a really subtle one that's just a frequency distinction. And so our early auditory processes already are starting to attune to the kinds of things that are going to be pretty important for distinguishing meaning later on. So that's kind of where I see speech perception is starting, is in those stages of the auditory system, where the auditory system is kind of like keying in to certain factors that are specifically important for speech. They may also be shared with other kinds of auditory processing, but because speech is such an important signal when we're listening, you know, that's probably the most important thing that most of us do with our ears. It's all about that specific speech stuff. Once we have those kinds of cues, things that tell us whether we have an eh or an eh, then we need to go on and access words, right? So am I hearing bit or am I hearing bet? And so, you know, kind of up to that stage is where we think of speech perception as stopping. A lot of other things are going into this equation. So doing things like, as I mentioned before, figuring out who's doing the talking. Am I hearing Emily or Aiden right now? That's part of speech perception too. Listening to a new accent that I've never heard before and figuring out, oh, this talker actually, when they say bit, they actually meant bet. And so I need to do some adjustment of my kind of mapping so that I make sure that I access the right word for that person. So that's kind of the corner of it. Now, once you get on to sort of assembling words into meaning and relating them, the meanings of them together, that we might think of as more like language processing. So the business I'm kind of really most interested in is that part from your ears to really sort of accessing words.
Wow. That's so you could kind of say that like speech perception, that whole process is really what we think of as noise being converted to what our brain decides, oh, that's speech. Because everything is just noise, right? At a certain point in the auditory signal, but there's that boundary in our brain that goes, that's a human voice, that's a consonant, that's a vowel, this is speech. It's fascinating. It's so
cool. 100%. And you know, you're absolutely right. When it hits the cochlea, there's nothing about the way my voice is hitting your cochlea right now that's like fundamentally different than hearing a door slam or a dog bark until you start to extract those speech specific characteristics, things like the things that make it sound like vowels and consonants, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. And since we're on this topic, actually, I have a question about, you had mentioned phonemes before when we were talking about sort of when we opened up the topic, and I kind of want to go back to that just for a second, because, you know, we're talking about how our brain or how the auditory system kind of picks apart this stuff. But why does the brain somehow put these speech sounds that we're hearing into distinct categories? And if the speech signal is so ambiguous or so often ambiguous, how is it that we reach the correct category? Or is that not even the right way to think about this? Like, are speech sounds essentially just symbols, auditory symbols to us, like anything else? Or is that a gross simplification?
I think unfortunately this is like a semester long topic that you've hit on. No, this is fantastic. This is like a big question, right? And I think the answer to some of this stuff is we don't quite know. But so let's back up and talk about what phonemes are. So, you know, when we think about writing systems, we have letters, right? What we call graphemes. Mm-hmm. In English, we have things like a B sound, which is a B. But there's not a one-to-one correspondence between the written letter and the sound. And so you can think of those sounds as being kind of like letters, but they are the sounds that we have in English. So we have sounds like E and I and A and A. And a phoneme is just a sound change that makes a difference for meaning. And we assemble words out of phonemes. So the word bit is assembled out of b, I, and ta. Okay. Which happen luckily to correspond to the B, I, and T, but we try to ignore writing when we're thinking about sound, because it can often trip us up. Especially. So Aiden, your question's kind of deep here, which is what we're trying to do is access words, right? And words we think are made of these component parts or sort of combinations of them. And so, you know, ultimately, I actually have to figure out, are you saying bit or pit? Are you saying bit or bet? And so at some point, we have to use that acoustic information to, as you say, kind of like put things into a category, right? I got to decide, is it an I or is it an E? And so that process seems to be kind of built into the perceptual system, where we take the input and we kind of like to chunk it into categories. And in fact, there's kind of this famous concept known as categorical perception. And what that means is not that like you're listening just in, you know, I'm only aware of buh, ih, and tuh, right? As sort of like primitives. We're aware of all of that nuance that's coming in the auditory system. But at the end of the day, we are kind of creating these decision boundaries or functional units that allow us at the end of the day, well, I got to decide, is it bit or pit? Is it bit or bet? And so what we end up doing sort of on the fly is taking this rich acoustic input that's kind of varied and, like, you know, sort of all over the place, and lumping or drawing boundaries around sounds in order to do this important thing, which is to understand what the message is. So there's a lot of complexity in how this happens. There are certain areas of the brain that seem really sensitive to contrasts between speech sounds. So there's an area in the left superior temporal gyrus, which is near an area that's called Wernicke's area, which you may classic. Eventually touch on. Yeah, classic, right? It's kind of comes to us from classic neuropsychology, that is really sensitive to distinctions between those speech categories, things like ba versus pa or I versus a. But the answer is our brains are super flexible, right? And so if I meet somebody who has a different way of pronouncing ba and pa, I'm going to adjust that in my brain really quickly. And so these aren't sort of fixed or set in stone kinds of categories, but kind of things that are useful for us as we get on to meaning.
Yeah, Emily, I know you have a question. I just wanted to add a comment to that. I love the way that you've described all this, especially the word contrast. I think that's the key here. It's like when we think about understanding a speech sound or a phoneme or understanding things in context, it's like you can't do any of this in a vacuum. It's necessarily contrastive, this whole process. It's like the difference between a P and a B. Our brain is just going, no, let's compare these two things. Are they the same? Are they different? Okay, next set of phonemes, next set of vowels. Like it's amazing to me that like this whole complex process is really just a series of these almost calculations that our brains are doing on these contrastive units. And it's the summation of those contrastive units that gives you the meaning.
Totally. And I think the meaning is something that is like the important thing, right? Because, right. You know, my brain is definitely not built just to like sit there and go, right? Make those decisions. What I care about is like, what did you just say to me? Was it back or pack? Was it bit or pit, right? I'm trying to communicate. And so these acoustic distinctions really need to be processed in service of making those distinctions and meaning, those contrastive distinctions that you were talking about, Aiden.
Speaking of and hitting back on the question that we originally came up with accents, and how some people kind of struggle with imitating accents or, you know, deciphering certain accents versus other people who it comes naturally to. Do we have kind of a scientific answer to why is that some people are more phonologically fit or sensitive than others? And does this kind of relate back to the research you're currently doing with what you hit on earlier with context versus people who are more phoneme centered with their?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, super good question. I mean, so when I was kind of being raised as a cognitive scientist, when we were talking about the way people use language, we had sort of one category of quote unquote typical language users. And if you had a language disorder, okay, you may have a different kind of route to understanding. But the idea that I was sort of raised in is that if you are a typical user of language, you're kind of equally good. You're all kind of the same in the way that you perceive and produce language. That was my understanding growing up as a baby scientist. And, you know, in the last 5 to 10 years in my research, we've really been curious about this idea that not everybody kind of does language exactly the same way. And I think this question really hits on one way where we can all hear this, which is in how we do things like imitation or voices. So I love listening to somebody like Bill Hader is my favorite. He can do these impressions of people that are like eerily good, right? You would swear that person is in the room. And then, you know, you do occasionally encounter other actors, and I wouldn't ever name anybody, but you encounter some actors that are trying to do an accent. And you're like, oof, that was rough, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right. I love this person. I love their performance. They're so good at inhabiting a role, but really that accent is a little not there. And so I got really curious about this question. And just through some kind of good luck, I got hooked up with a faculty member over in the drama department at UConn, Jennifer Scapetis-Tyser. And she is a dialect coach, right? And so I was curious about these individual differences. And I was like, okay, well, Jen probably knows why it is that some people are good at this and some people aren't, because she works with actors. Like she literally goes to work on theater productions and Broadway things and says, okay, I got to get you to do a North English accent. We're going to go. So we started having these amazing conversations. And, you know, it turned out she had a lot of insight as to what might make somebody a good accent producer. But we still didn't kind of know that much for sure about whether those things were the things that were really like predicting good accent users or good accent imitators. So we did a study a few years ago. It was started before the pandemic and is about to be kind of make its way into the public view, where we had just a ton of people come in and imitate a bunch of accents. And then they did a bunch of other tasks to see which of those other tasks predicted whether you were really good at accents. Oh. So Yeah. So one idea that, you know, she proposes, maybe it's sort of about your personality, whether you're more introverted or extroverted, whether you're more open to experience or not. We thought it might have to do, Emily, with what kind of you were saying, something about like the way that you're perceiving those fine-grained distinctions in the phonetic category. So something about really how you're hearing the accent and processing it that way. One of our collaborators proposed, maybe it's about actually like literally how you're moving your mouth, right? Are you really good at tongue twisters, for instance? So we tested people on a whole bunch of these things, and the results were really fun. So what we found out was that, sure enough, how well you move your mouth, right? Your tongue twisters ability. What we actually had people do is come in and they have to say the string of syllables pataka as fast as they can.
Oh, okay.
So, you guys want to do it?
Yeah.
Ready?
I would try it.
All right, let's just try it. Okay.
Okay.
So I'm going to have you both go at once. It's going to be a total nightmare, but I mean, you can say pataka five times as fast as you can. So I'll have you count, but then just stop when you're done. Ready? On your mark, get set, go.
Pataka, 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 pataka.
Okay. Yeah. Right. And so I think you ended about the same time in that little race, but some people can do it really quick. Some people are slower. So it turned out the speed at which you can do that predicts how well you can imitate accents.
Oh, I did not know that.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
Having some musical ability, so being able to like remember pitch contours, that also seems to predict accent ability. So something about your ability to kind of encode those musical characteristics of the voice, maybe even the rise and fall of intonation that we have in a voice. And then also on the personality side, something to do with like this quality known as openness. All about that. Sort of, what's that?
That's like the, what was that test where it was like, I'm an ENFJ, I'm an INFJ.
Yeah.
It's
a flavor of that. Yeah. So this is the one that we use is called the Big Five Personality Inventory, and you can go take it online if you want. And see how high you are on openness. And the kinds of questions people get there are things like, would you be interested in like going to a concert if you didn't know the artist? Or do you enjoy going to museums or trying new foods out? So, right. It's sort of like about trying new things and sort of openness to kind of new experiences. So if you're someone who embraces those kinds of things, and maybe is a little willing to take a risk and be embarrassed, you end up being better at imitating accents. So it's a super fun study to do. We actually had some people who were trained in there who naturally are very good at accents, but some of our very best imitators turned out to be people who had no drama experience, like just random psych undergrads who were just phenomenally good at this task. So, you know, that I think
the most revealing thing, honestly.
Yeah, right? So, you know, there's so many questions here, right? So we were just sort of testing how these things co-vary, but one of the things we really want to know is how much can this be trained? This is really important, right? Because from Jen's professional perspective, her business is to get people to be able to do dialects and accents well in their performances. So it's really important to kind of figure out like what kinds of training would help people be able to, you know, not have a clunker of an accent in that role. It's also got interesting connections to speech language pathology, because when we think about the kinds of vocal training we sometimes are doing with speech sound disorders, with voice disorders, it could be that some of these things that we've overlooked in the past might be things that we want to work on. So it's a fun area to explore. Would love to get like a Bill Hader in to do these tasks. Bill, if you're out there, we're waiting for you.
Yes. There's a spot ready for you.
Yeah, exactly. The chair is warmed up. We're ready to go. But I think that what it boils down to is that it probably is the case that there are certain things that we kind of come to the table with. We're all like better and worse at certain things. But it's also going to be the case that if you work on it, you're going to get better, right? That's one thing I've definitely learned over my career is that our language system is really flexible. It's really plastic. And so with the right kinds of experience and training, we do tend to see people get better.
Wow. There's one thing, like, I love the parameters that you described in the experiment. That is super interesting to me, just all the different ways you were measuring these things. And I just love that, like, the least, it, like, the people who are not in theater, who didn't have experience, like, necessarily imitating accents, like, tended to be the best performers. That is just, like, so compelling to me for some reason. It's just, yeah, it's wild.
Yeah. I should say that a lot of our actors did really, really well too. So we're not going to throw them under the bus, but yeah, it isn't necessarily the case that, you know, you can find these kind of expert mimics in a lot of interesting, unexpected places. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And also, just, this is another great example in general of how, like we said at the top of the show, language is just involved in everything that we're doing. It's in performance, it's in imitation. It's just such, it's so ingrained in us. It's just fascinating.
At the end of the day, it makes a lot of sense, right? So I could hear the differences between an accent perfectly well. Like, I might be able to say, ooh, that's a great Scottish accent, or that's not a great Scottish accent. But if my mouth can't do that, yes, if my sort of tongue and lips can't move with the right kind of precision, then it's not going to come out of my mouth in a way that's convincing.
No, and absolutely. So
I think we've got, like, vocal athletes, right? We've got, yes, people who are just, they're like gymnasts with their lips and their tongue, and they're able to really be precise in that kind of imitation. I think that's super cool. You know, sometimes people really seem to kind of get that sort of phonology, those sounds of a new language really easily. Some people don't. And so one interesting question is whether people who are good at imitating accents are also good at that second language phonology. So yes. That will be an interesting thing to study.
Yes, maybe a next step after your, I know you're so busy with all the different research, but maybe another question that you can add to your,
yeah,
bank of what to do next.
That was my question too. It's like, for people learning other languages, like, you know, this idea of being phonologically fit, what is it about? Not just being able, is it just a perception thing? Are people picking up on these quote phonological rules or differences and they just don't know it? Or is it like something else going on where it's like, yes, it's the perception might be more finely tuned, but then their brain is able to do some kind of calculation or I don't know, zoom out, I guess, and extrapolate those phonological rules, quote rules, that we all have to learn, either when we're learning our first language or learning another language. Like, what is that essentially? That to me is fascinating.
Totally. I mean, I think that's another mystery, and it happens, you know, we're much more aware of it when we hear different accents, right? Different non-native accents in this case, mm-hmm, but it's happening on the perception side too. So one, yeah, of the things that we often say in the lab is that, yes, people speak with an accent, right? If you're speaking a language that's not your first language, you usually kind of betray yourself as a speaker of that, of a different language. So for instance, I speak some Spanish. No one would ever mistake me for a native Spanish speaker. They know that I am an English speaker. Yeah. But we also listen with an accent. So we listen, when I'm listening to Spanish, I'm listening through my ears, which are tuned to English, my brain, which is tuned to listening to English. And I have to have learned over time to listen to the Spanish phonology and learn to map those phonemes the way that it's done in Spanish. As you say, it seems to be true that some people are a little bit more phonologically fit. They seem to pick up on those differences more quickly. So we had a line of work in the lab that we pursued for a long time, looking at how people learn to perceive differences between sounds that aren't part of their language. The example that we used is one that's drawn from Hindi. And the reason that we use this distinction is that it's really, really hard for people like me who grew up speaking English to hear. So I'm going to try it. And if you're a Hindi speaker out there, you're going to forgive me, I hope, for mangling this. But it's the difference between something like tha, where your tongue is right on your teeth, and da, where your tongue is curled back, sort of touching the sort of middle part of your hard palate. So that's tha, da.
Oh, that would be like the difference. So it's like the interdental almost versus the retroflex sound.
Got it. Yeah, it's dental versus retroflex. So like, I can do those. If you play those back to me, I'm probably not going to be a whole lot better than Chance at telling you which one is which, right? It's really difficult for me to hear. But if you've grown up hearing those different sounds, they're as different to you as duh and ta are to people who grew up speaking English. So we've done a number of studies where we train people to do these distinctions. And it's really interesting to see the huge variability we see in people's ability to learn those sounds. But then also, as you say, Aiden, to kind of generalize from what you've learned in, let's say you've learned da, da, you've learned in the A context, can you now do D, D, right? Seems like it should be easy. It's actually pretty difficult.
But not, wow. I just love what you said about accents are, they go both ways, right? Like if you think of accents as sort of like this phonetic or phonological filter that we have, it's external just as much as it is internal. Like we have accents when we listen and we have accents when we speak. I never had thought about it that way, but it's so true.
Yeah, it's kind of like a two-way filter. I think that's a really good way of putting it. It's been a really fun conversation, you guys. And yeah, I mean, unfortunately, like I've spent the last 20 years studying this stuff. So, you know, it, there's at least 20 years of stuff to talk about.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely. Wow. Well, I mean, I guess my final question before we wrap up, and this is a bigger question. So, you know, feel free to answer in any way you can, or just say, you know, I can't answer that right now. But, you know, you've mentioned that at the end of the day, all you're trying to do is kind of peek under the hood of language to see how it works, to see how it's constructed, to see how people use it in different ways, like that personal aspect of language. But in your years dedicated to the questions we've been discussing today, what to you is sort of the biggest takeaway or one of the bigger takeaways about the way that we make sense of the noise around us?
That's a great question. Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest takeaway for me is that our brains are extraordinarily flexible. And as adults, we sort of come to the conclusion that language acquisition is done and we're kind of stuck with what we've got. But it's actually not true. We're doing all kinds of adjustments to how we're hearing and how we're speaking as we interact with different talkers, people with different accents, people of different ages, as we learn new things and new words. And so language acquisition, in some sense, is sort of a lifelong process. It continues to change and adapt and be flexible. And so that flexibility is sort of my favorite thing about language, and one that we'll be studying for years to come.
Wow. Okay. Amazing answer. I think that's a great way to kind of wrap up. Thank you, Dr. Myers, so much for helping us kind of unpack today's central question, today's linkery about speech perception and the ways that sort of our brains and our auditory systems are able to just pick apart this auditory chaos so effortlessly and allow us to kind of communicate with each other and the world around us. So thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.